You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina.
Well, hello and welcome to the May episode of the cycling podcast Femina. Yes, you join us again in our virtual cabana because it is, of course, that time of the year when we talk about the Spanish stage racing season. We had the Vuelta Femenina. We've had, Durango, the classic. We had Itzulia, and we've just finished having Vuelta a Burgos. So in our virtual cabana today, I should say, hola to my two lovely co-hosts, Rebecca Charlton.
Hola, ¿qué tal?
Oh, muy bien. Very nice. And of course, the almost native Mandarin speaker, Denny Gray.
Hello, Rose. Thank you for that brilliant introduction. Always bigging me up. Thank you.
I was actually going to ask you about your virtual drinks that you're having in your virtual cabana. I would be going for a virtual sangria is what I was going to go for. I don't know about you two. Because it's beautiful, sunny. It is like we are in beautiful, sunny Spain, isn't it?
Yeah, sangria does hit the mark, doesn't it, on a day like today. I'm going through a period of abstinence, so I'm going to go for a sparkling water with ice and a lime, which is boring, but classic.
I mean, it's even more boring that it doesn't actually exist. It's just a virtual sparkling water.
Our sparkling water doesn't even exist.
I just love sparkling water. I'm sorry. I just cannot get
so
enough
do
of
it. I. That was going to be my drink of choice. Gosh, we need to spice this up a bit, don't we?
I feel like we could just easily make this happen for both of you. It really would taste.
It's not a big ask, really, is it?
Well, we have just watched Vuelta a Burgos. That, of course, finished on Sunday afternoon. So we kind of gone swept through the Spanish racing block. Oh, I should say, actually, before I forget, that the mini feature is a really good one. I know I say that every month, but it is a really good one this month. And that is an interview that I did with Juana Somarriba, who was the last Spanish woman to win a women's Grand Tour before Paula Blasi, of course, did it at the Vuelta Femenina this year. I mean, she's just a remarkable rider. She won she was a time trial world champion in 2003. She won the sort of Tour de France Femme Forerunner, the Grand Boucle, three times. She had the yellow jersey there, and she also won the Giro d'Italia twice as well. So she was just a phenomenal, phenomenal champion rider. So it was great to catch up with her. And I did it on a new system which we had a video call, and it translated what we were saying. I spoke English and she spoke Spanish, and it translated as we went, which was really cool and a bit sort of eerie. But yes, so that will be coming up. A really great speaker. Obviously, me and Becca, we spoke about the Vuelta Femenina, didn't we, in our Arrive episode that we put out a few weeks ago. But we've had Itzulia and Burgos since then. But it's kind of had a huge change of personnel, hasn't it, Rebecca? Like the riders that we're seeing here are not the riders that we normally see contending in GC's competitions necessarily. We also don't have Demi Vollering, who's previously sort of dominated these races, which has kind of left the path clear for a few other names to appear.
It really has. And yeah, we're in the middle of a massive heat wave, aren't we, in the UK at the moment. So we've felt very Spanish whilst watching these races in our separate locations. One day we will make it back together in a cabana. But it has been really interesting with real life sparkling water. And I also, sorry, I keep laughing to myself because I only remember one line from GCSE Spanish, which was that I liked the ambience of a shopping mall. And I don't know why. This is the one thing that I've managed to retain in my memory of GCSE Spanish. Me gusta ir a compras porque me gusta gastar dinero y el ambiente. I also like to spend money. God knows why that's embedded in my brain.
Trouble, I think, Becca. Just having those two lines in the shopping mall.
Who knows? Yeah, I think back to the point, Rose, when we realised that we weren't going to see Demi Vollering at this point in the season fielding these races, of course that whole narrative changed, and it has been completely wide open. And we've been talking about different riders that have been able to definitely come to the fore and take on a more leadership type role in the absence of other teammates in that. And of course the overall change in the calendar with the Giro moving has been quite interesting, because yeah, we've got the absence of some of the bigger names we're expecting to explode back onto the scene for the next Grand Tour and beyond into the Tour. But I feel like, yeah, I'm not quite sure where to start, because there's been so many different talking points. And yeah, we've just come fresh off the victory a couple of hours ago of Yara Kastelein, and I'm sure we'll get into that. But yeah, the way she rode on the final stage of that was such a big talking point, how she secured that. But I feel like there's once again been a different talking point every day with many, many riders, I guess, seizing their opportunity to try something a little bit different this week.
Well, let's talk about the Yara Kastelein win. She won the Vuelta a Burgos, but she was doing phenomenally well in Itzulia as well, wasn't she? I mean, she came second in Itzulia. And actually, when you look at the GC for the Itzulia race, I mean, Misha Bredewold won it by 21 seconds from Yara Kastelein, but that really gives a really skewed picture of how it went, because actually Misha Bredewold, she got a good bit of advantage, didn't she, on that first stage, which meant Yara Kastelein lost time there. But actually, Misha Bredewold was going for all the intermediate sprints. She obviously won a stage, so she got bonus seconds there. So she had 29 seconds of bonus seconds that she gained during that race. Yara Kastelein gained 6 seconds in comparison. So actually, if you wiped those bonus seconds out, and obviously part of racing is knowing when to put your efforts in and where to claw back those seconds. But if you took that out, then actually Yara Kastelein would have come away from that with the win, in fact, for that race. The picture, it kind of ignored how great Yara Kastelein has been these past few weeks. And she just showed it on that final mountain in the Vuelta a Burgos, didn't she, Denny? Because it seemed that Evita Muzik, who made the move, and it was just Muzik and Kastelein who went away alone, it seemed that Muzik had that totally in control. And we're very used to seeing FDJ at the moment very much in control and knowing when to play their cards, and each rider knowing exactly, you know, what they can give and when and how to get the win. But we saw Kastelein surprise her there, didn't we? And ride away in quite a dominant fashion, actually.
Yeah, she's a rider, isn't she, that's always been there or thereabouts in stage racing, but has never actually won a stage race. We saw her do so well in 2023 at the Tour de France Femmes, where she was kind of in contention for quite some time. She won a stage, of course, which was her only previous pro race, nearly won the mountains classification, but she's never won a stage race. And maybe, as you say, she was perhaps a little bit underestimated going into Burgos, although she'd had an incredible Itzulia coming second overall. She's probably, maybe Misha Bredewold would argue differently, but maybe being the rider of these two races, given her GC results in the end. And it was a perfectly timed move, wasn't it? She talked after the race about just following Evita Muzik on that final climb. She said she did the same last week in Itzulia with Antonio Niedermayer, and she just kind of waited and waited and waited, and then waited for the steepest bit, and then yeah, attacked just at the right moment, and Evita Muzik couldn't follow. So it was a kind of brilliant kind of bit of tactical riding, as well as obviously having the legs to finish it off. So yeah, a huge confidence boost for a rider that's been promising this kind of result for quite a long time.
The way she rode that final climb was of course really pivotal, but it was something you can really dissect, because she just played it to perfection. And it was just such a sort of case study, wasn't it, of somebody having recce'd a stage, knowing exactly what their capabilities are on that gradient. And she, you could see Evita Muzik, couldn't you, just trying everything she could, because she knew it was coming, and she was just looking, trying to force the sort of change of dynamic, trying to move across the road from her to really read that situation. And Kastelein just had that ultimate confidence, didn't she, to say, nope, I'm not going yet, I know when I'm going. And that explosive power, you know, she's a multi-discipline background rider, isn't she, with such power on the cyclocross bike. And we kind of see those powerhouse riders make that transition over, don't we, in so many famous cases. And yeah, when Castelein went, there was just nothing in that moment of explosive power that Musique could do to answer that. And it was interesting, actually, after she did that explosive move, watching Musique behind, because actually she, it's not like she was drifting back and back, was it? You know, she was still in sight the whole time. But I think that's why we can see that it came down to that really big power move that Castelein knew, like, that's the place I'm going to try it. And she pulled it off.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because Evita Musique was also, I mean, she was in flying form. We saw that on the last stage of Burgos. But we also saw in Itzulia, she was up there. I do wonder what FDJ are going to make of their little Spanish block. Not that they have to be kind of on top all the time, but when they have, they obviously have Demi Vollering in their ranks. Obviously, she's away preparing for the Giro, which is almost is imminent, isn't it? They also have such a strong team of these other kind of leaders or co-leaders. Juliette Bertet has been absolutely incredible. I mean, she has almost, like, with her new name, her new married name of Bertet, been like a bit of another rider, hasn't she, than the Juliette Labousse that we're used to seeing. I mean, she's really been out there and gunning for it and a lot more kind of active and seems to have had a lot more firepower this year than previously. And Evita Musique, and it kind of always was that Demi Vollering was going to go alongside these two great French hopes, that was Bertet and Evita Musique. But it's interesting coming away from Itzulia and Burgos. Itzulia was particularly kind of peculiar from an FDJ standpoint, I would say, because they had three riders in the top 10. And those riders were Lauren Dixon, Evita Musique and Juliette Bertet. I mean, Lauren Dixon finished on the podium, but it almost seemed like during that race they really wanted, I guess they really knew that Evita Musique was in really good form, as we saw in Burgos. And they kind of wanted, is it fair to say they kind of wanted Evita Musique to win that, or be the rider that got the podium instead of Lauren Dixon? Or they weren't expecting Lauren Dixon to be in the form that she was in. Denny, how did you read that? I know you know Lauren Dixon well from the domestic scene. But yeah, how did you read that kind of dynamic that was in Itzulia?
It's one of those cases where we've seen it before this year, haven't we? Where in the Tour Down Under, for example, UAE ADQ had, I think it was three riders, didn't they, in the final stage there, and they still contrived not to win. But, you know, this isn't a new phenomenon. But I think with FDJ United on that final climb, Radevold was dropped, and with 10K to go, and there was a front group of seven, and that included three FDJ United riders, Dixon, Musique and Bertet, of course. And then there has been a kind of a debate on in the news about whether they could have done more. So I know some people have argued that, you know, perhaps they ought to have ridden for Dixon, got behind her. She was, you know, been riding so well all week. They could have definitively got rid of Radevold on that climb, but no one seemed to take up the mantle, did they? And I think clearly it felt like they hadn't quite worked out their designated leader on that stage. And I don't know if it's fair to say it's easy to say in hindsight they got it wrong, because maybe at the time they thought it's better to have options and not burn any matches for riders like Musique and Bertet, who of course are so strong in their own right. But in hindsight, it does look like they perhaps should have played it differently. On the other hand, you know, Lauren Dixon is very, very new to racing. She's only been racing for 2 years. When I interviewed her at the British Continental last year, she was telling me how she'd started racing in 2024 because a friend had seen a ride of hers on Strava. She does have a sporting background, but a friend had seen a ride of hers on Strava and said, "Oh, you should enter a race." And she Googled how to enter a race, and away she went. She started racing, but she's had a remarkable rise, but she's clearly got a lot to learn about her own capabilities and also perhaps about, you know, how to take up a leadership role. And we don't know. There's been very little word from the team about the conversations that were had in the race. But I think it's probably a learning point. I think that's probably the best way to look at it for Lauren and the team. And could they have done it differently? Definitely. But I don't know. I think these things are easy to call out, aren't they, after the race, and perhaps not so easy when you're in them.
I think that's so true. It's so complicated, isn't it? And as you say, hindsight's a wonderful thing. And I feel like it's a different scenario, but I think when Guy Raiolini first really started dominating on pure climbs, and actually there was a narrative around that, wasn't there, saying, why is the whole team not just prioritising Raiolini? But actually, I think she herself said, you know, I'm not actually at a point in my career where I'm in that out and out leadership role. Actually, that's not the team's priority this week. And I think, yeah, when somebody shows so much promise and are actually ultimately in a great position, it's easy to say, as you've mentioned, Denny, above, like, it's very easy to say, why did they not just rally everything around that rider? But they don't know. They ultimately don't know, when they've got so many different cards to play, how that's going to look at the start of a race. And we've seen people switch plans so many times within the winning, you know, a one day race, let alone a stage race. So yeah, I think it's easier said than done sometimes to know how each rider's going to fare. And when you're going to get a new talent that's rising and appraising and learning all the time.
We've praised FTJ United this year because they have been so good at switching plans, haven't they, when things haven't gone right. Strada Bianchi was the kind of the prime example of that, when Franziska Koch and Elise Chabé had to turn from domestiques for Damey Vollering to race winners in the end. And so they've done a brilliant job this year of actually bringing riders, progressing riders that were perhaps had lots of potential to get good results. And I think for me, that's the story of this race, really, because this block, because Lauren Dixon's had a remarkable season, having never ridden in the World Tour before, only started racing at UCI level last year, suddenly finds herself on the podium in Itzulia, very esteemed company. She also finished second at Vuelta at Extremadura, fourth at Durango. She's really adjusted brilliantly to the World Tour, and we talk about people like Kat Ferguson and others as the kind of the next wave of British talent coming through, but Lauren Dixon, she's albeit 26, very new to racing, and definitely one to watch now in stage racing in the future.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. Talking about kind of changing of plans, but we had another key rider in Itzulia was Dominika Vlodicic, wasn't it, who won two stages there. She spoke also that, I mean, they started, I think, with four riders and then ended up with three riders during the race, the UAE team. I mean, they're quite used to, we saw them last year at the Tour de France FAM, didn't we, riding with very few riders there. I mean, they lost Elisa Longo Borghini, who was going to be their main kind of GC hope at the Tour de France FAM. And she wasn't riding, and they had to kind of rally around Dominika Vlodicic and find new ways of winning. And Laura Gillespie also was in that team. But yeah, she...
Maeva Skibban,
of course, yeah. Who, you know, we also saw right at the end of Burgos as well. But, you know, they've really shown a lot of versatility as a team. And we've kind of seen that all season, haven't we? But Dominika Vlodicic there, I mean, she would have felt probably a bit sad to have missed out on not getting the win there, actually, because Misha Bradavol kind of made the difference on that first stage, didn't she, that she managed to hold on to. But Dominika Vlodicic had a virus. I don't know why I didn't do our line, Denny. Dominika Vlodicic.
Vlodicic, what a rider.
I can't believe I missed that. But I mean, she had a virus during the Ardennes, which had been her target, and she didn't know what form she was in. And then obviously just grew through Itzulia to come away with two World Tour wins. That was huge for her, Rebecca. And it also leaves UAE, I imagine, with a bit of a selection headache, to be honest, because they also have in their ranks Elisa Longo Borghini and Maeva Skibban. And they have also Paola Blasi, who's just been phenomenal in the Ardennes and then also phenomenal winning the Volta Femenina.
There's a lot of talent in there, isn't there? When you put it like that, as we've talked about before, you know, with the likes of FTJ, they have so many options in that team. And Vlodacek is a rider, I think I've probably, you know, sung her praises in this sense before, but she really excites me. I think she's such a big personality, and her potential for everything she's bringing already to the sport and what she will bring in the future, I think, is massive. I just find her really entertaining. And when she gives a post-race interview, she's always so, I think she's very modest, actually, for what she is achieving. She's incredibly modest. And I think it was interesting to kind of appraise how the race went for her. And she was obviously delighted to take those victories. But it was interesting looking at her Instagram post afterwards. She said, "I'm trying to find myself again, to figure out where I belong and what truly brings me joy. And I hope the next few weeks will be all about that." And I thought that was quite an interesting comment, because she's just so good. But she always seems to kind of just quietly appraise what she's done, look at the learnings from it, rather than just being like, "Ah, that was great." You know, she's obviously delighted with how many results she's got recently, but she's also going away and thinking, right, how can I play that even better next time? And so that's why she excites me, because I just think she's going to just get better and better. And yeah, we're seeing her being able to take more and more opportunities.
I think it's hard also, because it kind of, her comment is quite sort of reflective, isn't it? And I think it a little bit plays into that idea of, I mean, obviously, Dominika Vlodacek was hoping to go to the Ardennes and do well. And then obviously her teammate, Paola Blasi, goes and does extremely well there. I think it must also leave a little bit of a sense in a team like that of what am I going for? What's my target in this team? Because it does feel a little bit like they're becoming like an SD Works type team, where they just seem to have so many cards to play, and everyone is so scared of you know, they get into a group with one rider and then they're terrified that we saw it, didn't we, actually, at Burgos several times, this kind of play where you get into a breakaway with Amisha Braderwald and you just feel like you have to work, even though you don't want to drag her to the line, but because behind Lorena Vibas is in the group behind, you have to do that. And then you just feel like you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. But I think UAE have kind of got that quality coming, and FTJ, which makes it a really exciting, extremely competitive time in the peloton at the moment. Let's talk a little bit about SD Works, because we kind of actually saw flavours of old SD Works, didn't we? I guess in that play, that dynamic that I just spoke about, where, you know, you're in the group with one strong SD Works rider and you're terrified of the SD Works rider that's behind you as well. Because we did see kind of shades of that. Of course, that kind of all kicked off in the Volta Femenina, where we saw Lotta Kopecky win and we saw Misha Braderwald be gifted almost the win there by Lotta Kopecky. It was like, oh, well, you know, SD Works got it such in control, we can just hand them out here. And then seeing the return of Anna van der Breggen to, you know, winning ways, you know, in the big mountains also there. And then we have seen your favourite, I should be coming to you, Rebecca, of course, Lorena Vibas's fan club president. Yeah, who, Ninka Vinka, who was it?
There's space for all my fan clubs in my heart.
But Lorena Vibas obviously won two stages of Burgos. I mean, just look, and won by such a margin.
And we have said this before, but I think there is always that danger with Vibas where we just go, yeah, okay, let's just skirt over that because she took another victory. But we have to analyse the way she took them. She is just reading the race, as she always does, to win in every way she possibly can. And I think if you look at the way she read both of those finals on the first two stages, it was really interesting, because she can do it where she rides away with pure dominance and has a few bite lengths, or she can wait and she can just wait for that person to pounce and then match it and then just give herself that little bit of a comfortable edge. I think she's remarkable. Her form is just looking better and better and better, and everything that she's giving us an insight into, what she's doing off the bike as well, all her strength and conditioning. I just think she's getting better and better. She's just, every time we think she might be touchable, she seems to become untouchable again. And she's yet again looking at how she can just stay a step ahead of everybody else. But yeah, I thought that, yeah, the takeaway from that is the fact that she didn't just win it, she won it by a big margin, and she won in two different ways of just reading her rivals, basically, and just picking and choosing when she was going to go. And she can measure that effort, can't she? She can go, right, not yet, got this, got it. You know, it's brilliant. It's just such a generational talent, isn't she?
Generational talent of your heart.
Yes, thank you.
It's actually, we've perhaps talked Esty Works Pro Time down a little bit this year. You know, they haven't been as competitive as they have been, you know, previously. But I think this is a brilliant team performance by them as well. Not just Misha Bredevold, of course, who had a brilliant couple of races, but even in the races where Vibus was winning, I think they did some brilliant displays of teamwork, both in terms of the lead out she got, but also they were keen just to get in the breaks. So teams that were trying to think, you know, the issue every team has every race Phoebus is in is how do you foil her? And, you know, there were lots of teams trying to get in the break and get up the road before it came down to a bunch sprint. But what Esty Works did so well at was actually getting in the break with those teams, where Bredevold included. And that meant it was very difficult for teams to play any other tactics. And I know some of the Dutch press were calling it kind of the Anna era playbook, you know, the days when Anna van der Breggen previously rode for Esty Works or Bols Dolmans, as they were, used to be called. And the team just had that collective strength, and that they were definitely showing that collective strength in these two races. It was a really good all round performance, I felt, from the team. And for a team that hasn't perhaps had the success it might have wanted outside of Lorena Vibus's victories this year, I think they'll take a lot of confidence from these races as well.
It just gives it so much more clout as a talking point now, doesn't it? The fact that they hadn't had it all their way and they're just coming back to that, and all that, you know, they had a lot of setbacks and they just weren't purely dominant at points, and they are looking to just be back to Esty Works ways, which has been brilliant to discuss, hasn't it? Firstly, Misha Bredevold, she just rode so well, didn't she? Really, really well. Not only in form, but how she was reading the whole race, in both races. And on the final stage of Burgos as well, the way she just rode smart and kept in contention and did everything she needed to do when she totally wasn't in her comfort zone at that point. You know, she really rode well. And I think sometimes, I guess it goes back to a lot of things we've said about having so many different talents in one squad and where do you prioritise people. And we obviously see Misha Bredevold do a lot of work for teammates and sometimes get overshadowed and not be talked about as much as she would be. So I feel like, yeah, she's been the bridesmaid a lot, hasn't she, in these races, and she's really come to the fore now. I was looking back at her background, and actually she's 25, isn't she? And I feel like that always surprises me because she feels like she's been around for so long now, because she started as a junior and was so talented from day one, that I feel like, yeah, gosh, is she actually only 25? And back when she was really breaking onto the scene as a junior rider, she had a really bad accident. She was hit by a truck when she was training, I think for Junior Worlds back in 2018, and it left her with a traumatic brain injury, a broken pelvis, multiple broken ribs, broken vertebrae, and doctors were questioning if she'd ever walk again. And I think sometimes we don't talk enough about how remarkable Bredevold is, and she's obviously overcome the odds with that, been the rider for everybody else that we know she can be. And then when she does get the opportunity, she just delivers, doesn't she? You know, she has her races that she's put her mark on, and we just go, yeah, she's a favourite for this, and she'll probably seal the deal.
I think that's the thing why she kind of slips under our radar. I mean, not as a domestique at all, because she has always been the most, I would say, the most key domestique that Esty Works actually have at the moment. If you look at the stages, the races and stages that she's done this year, I mean, she's been at all of the major ones. I mean, Omloop, Strade Bianche, Binder, Ronde van Vlaanderen, Amstel, Flesch, Liège. Then she did Vuelta Femenina, Itzulia, Burgos. I mean, she's done all of these world tour races, all of these really big, 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 big races. She has been there for the team. It's quite incredible, actually. She's always been there. Also, when, you know, in the Vollering years, when Vollering was SD work, she was there as a key domestique. I remember her kind of helping Demi Vollering through that difficult time at the Tour de France, where, you know, it felt like Vollering had been sort of left on the side of the road when she crashed and she was in the yellow jersey, and it seemed like her teammates had abandoned her. I mean, Misha Bredevold was so key there for keeping, she was almost like Demi Vollering's bodyguard for the rest of that week. You know, she was really always side by side with her and kind of protecting her, both from a kind of a media standpoint and from kind of, you know, almost kind of any sort of backlash that she got there. I mean, she was kind of really nurturing her through that. So she's really key as a sort of, from a morale point of view, not just being this extremely, extremely strong rider on a bike. And I think almost she gets a little bit overlooked because she makes it look so easy. It's that kind of sort of Anna van der Breggen effect, isn't it? That she looks like, I mean, what's the car which has a really long front? Is it an Aston Martin? Or I'm looking at two very bewildered people. I mean, I know that Rebecca can't actually drive, so, and whose family car is a pickup truck. So I don't know that knowing the differences between all these cars is going to be a strong point. But yeah, she's kind of like this beautifully designed machine. You know, she's so tall and long and leggy, and just like the power that she puts through that bike is absolutely phenomenal. And we saw that, didn't we? We saw that stage three of Vuelta Burgos when Maria Benito was way ahead on a sort of solo attack. And we just saw Bredevold just launch herself out of the pack and just slowly take the time away and then get up to Maria Benito and then just pull Maria Benito along for such a long way and then just, you know, win it out the front there. She's just like this, almost like a perfectly designed cyclist for being this huge sort of engine, and so key because, you know, the team needs her in a hilly stage or a mountainous stage. The team needs her to keep all the brakes in check and get them at the front onto the mountains. And then on the kind of flatter races, she's absolutely key in the lead out trained for Lorena Wiebe. So she's absolutely key. I do wonder, I don't know what you think, Denny. I mean, Misha Bredevold has been so strong these past few stages. I mean, it's kind of remarkable to me when I look back at it that she actually only won one stage of Itzulia and one stage of Burgos, because it felt like she won overall in Itzulia as well, but it felt like she'd almost won sort of six stages, so because she was so present in all of them, even in the mountains. But I do wonder, Denny, she does seem like such a committed domestique, but she reminds me a little bit of Marlon Reusser in that way that she has so much talent and maybe doesn't get loads of opportunities, but when she does it, I mean, she looks so phenomenal. Is there maybe room for her in the future to be thought more of as a leader, or do you think she would need to go somewhere else that wasn't SD Works in order to fulfill that? I mean, she's got a contract to be with the team next year as well, but is that something in the future that she will be more of a designated leader, or maybe, yeah, I mean, is that just not part of SD Works' plan, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, she's got the talent, hasn't she, to be a leader in probably most other teams in the World Tour. I think if she was in Lidl Trek or yeah, many other teams, you'd think she'd be the designated leader for many races. She's obviously, as you say, like we haven't probably celebrated her class enough over the last few years. And I agree with Becca. It feels like she's been around for ages and I can't believe she's only 25. But to win Plouay three times, to win its five stages in Itzulia, Amstel Gold, European Road Race Championships, you know, she's already got some big wins, and she's clearly capable of getting a lot more. But as you say, I think she's probably been not hamstrung, she's just a very good team player, and she's also been surrounded by riders that are, you know, incredible world-class athletes in Demi Vollering and Lorena Wiebes and Lotta Kopecky. So it's always going to be difficult when you've got teammates of that caliber to actually make the case that you should be a leader in any given race. But yeah, clearly lots of talent. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a clamour for her signature after she leaves. Oh, well, not after she leaves. We don't know if she's leaving, but at the end of 2027. Yeah, hugely talented rider. I mean, yeah, what more can you say? I don't think the Marlon Reusser comparison is interesting because we've kind of seen Reusser, although she's obviously had a lot of injury crashes and injury issues this year, but we've seen her kind of develop into a GC contender, narrowly lost out in the Giro last year. But I don't know if Bredevold will quite go in that direction. she's kind of more punchy, isn't she? But clearly in kind of on hilly terrain, if not mountainous terrain, she's a very, very dangerous rider.
Well, we did, of course, this Spanish block started, didn't it, with the Vuelta Femenina, where we saw another sort of upstart kind of move from Paula Blasi, which sort of a bit of a changing of the guard, wasn't it? Anna van der Breggen being in command in the leader's jersey into that last stage, and then Paula Blasi kind of showing what she was made of and not winning the stage, actually, that went to Petra Diasny, but doing plenty and doing more than enough to win the GC overall at the Vuelta Femenina. I was looking back to see when the last Spanish woman was before Paula Blasi, which was a bit of a surprise win from her perspective, wasn't that was Joana Somarriba. And I thought that would be make a very fitting feature for this month to talk to Joana about her triumphs and her progress and her upbringing. So, yes, please enjoy my mini feature with Joana Somarriba. Before Paula Blasi, there was another generational talent, one who wrote the opening golden chapter of Spanish women's cycling.
Soy Joana Somarriba. Pues somos cuatro hermanas.
I'm one of four sisters. When my parents took us to a bike shop, I went straight to the racing bike because it was truly the bike I liked, and I chose it.
Born into a Basque family with a devotion to cycling, Somarriba's choice of racing bike set her on a path that would make history, even if prospects for women at the time weren't so bright.
In those times, things were very difficult for women. I remember that very young, I started winning the Spanish championship. The Spanish team began taking us to race in France. There was very little budget to take us to the races, and it was always very difficult. But I always remember that after the races, I would come home knowing that this is what I love. I wanted to be a professional cyclist, and this was my dream, and no one was going to take it away from me, because the message was always somewhat negative. A woman on a bike has no future.
No tiene futuro.
Somarriba's future on the bike could have been very short-lived, in fact. Lying in a hospital bed with a herniated disc at the age of 19, the doctor put a box of tissues in front of her and told her she would never ride a bike again.
That doctor who told me I could never compete again is now 89 years old and is a very good friend of mine, who I love very much. The power of the mind is incredible. The power of dreams. The power to surpass yourself. The ability that humans have to fight for what they love. And I adore cycling. It has been and still is my life. And I have fought a lot for it. That injury was very tough because it always accompanied me. But I had the tools and good psychological training to handle it as best as could. For an athlete, as in my case, it made me stronger. It made me stronger and made me realize that with work, struggle, and resilience, in the end, you become tougher.
Somarriba became Spanish champion just a couple of years later, but it was only when her Spanish team took her to compete at the Giro d'Italia that her career lifted off. Team Alfa Lum saw her potential and brought her over to be in Italy full-time.
That was where the door to professionalism and fulfilling my dream opened for me. I had to catch that train, otherwise it would slip away. It was my opportunity, and I surrounded myself with people who believed in women's cycling, people who helped us, people who made us grow as cyclists. I had never had a team with a strategy and the support we could have there in Italy. And they always trusted me a lot, right from the beginning. They even saw many qualities in me, which I didn't necessarily see in myself. They always trusted me and helped me grow a lot in every way.
And it was with Alfa Lum that she enjoyed her biggest moment yet, at the 1999 Giro Femminile.
That Giro was special from the beginning. The flat stages were very tense. I remember that I fell and thought I had seriously injured my leg. And in that stage, where I had a bad fall, I reached the finish line and my leg was bruised. They treated me right there. I was a little scared because it was very hard for me to pedal with that leg. But I, thank God, gradually recovered from the impact. And after a few days, the Queen Stage arrived. I remember that Queen Stage, we climbed several mountain passes. And on the last pass, the three riders from the same team, Alfa Lum, were able to stay together. And honestly, it was so beautiful to cross the finish line with my teammate. It was something that brought us together, that strength, that struggle. And honestly, we enjoyed it so much. One of our teammates became the leader. And then in the time trial, she defended it very well. And in the end, I was able to achieve victory. But it was like a very team-oriented victory, very much ours. And we felt it with a lot of emotion. I remember that I was wearing pink at the start, and I remember enjoying every moment, going up to sign on, being with the fans, and I was like a child. I mean, just like a child who couldn't believe it. I think I kissed the pink jersey every day when I went to my room. From the hotel, I would hang it on the chair, and every day, the days I could wear it, I would cover it with kisses. Yes, because it was the jersey of struggle, of years of sacrifice, and of that dream. And it finally came true.
So Mariba's career wasn't just highlighted twice in pink, but also with yellow, no fewer than three times at the Grand Boucle. It took a lifetime of work and belief.
The first contact I had with the Women's Tour de France was when I was 14 to 15 years old, when I went to see a stage of the Orbisque. I went with a group of friends and we rode up on bicycles. Waiting for the men's Tour de France and the women's appeared was an impressive surprise for me because no one had told me. And there, Gianni Longo and Maria Canin would appear in the battle of the two. It is something that marked me forever. My relationship with the Tour de France was like from that moment saying, wow, I want to race the Tour de France. It's wonderful. It's wonderful how these women fight to climb. Climbing those mountains, how they fight to make their place in this men's sport. And it seemed incredible to me because, look, the sad thing about the situation was that no one had told me they were coming. But for me, it was very special. And from then on, my dreams and mindset were always about whether I would ever get to race the Tour de France in my life, and something that helped me to sacrifice myself, to fight. And in 1995, the day came, and it was very hard. Very hard. I remember I had a very tough time. I lost a lot of time in each stage. In the Queen stages, I was not used to climbing passes of 20 kilometers, 25 kilometers. And well, I think I lost 45 or 50 minutes to Fabiana Luperini. But my mindset didn't change. I climbed the passes thinking that someday I could do it. Being up there was a tough experience. But I also think it made me very strong to race that Tour de France without being 100% prepared. I was coming from a spinal injury. And for me, it was already a triumph to have been able to race that Tour de France.
That early baptism of fire eventually led to a memorable Grand Boucle victory in 2001.
The Tour de France started from Bilbao, and that was something that made me immensely excited. To race in front of our fans where we live in Euskadi, where there is a huge passion for cycling, with very specific training for the Tour, studying each stage. And quite honestly, it was a triumph and a huge dream. I had a great champion like Edith Puigiscaite on the team, who was also fighting for that victory. And we had a bit of rivalry between us. But we were both fair, and the road puts everyone in their place, in this case, each of us. And well, on the Tourmalet, we climbed it together. And then against the clock, it was decided because I was better in the time trial. I managed to achieve it, but within that rivalry that we had as colleagues, there was also a lot of respect. That was very important in the moment.
She retired not long after taking silver in the World Championship time trial in 2005. There could have certainly been more wins, but her heart was pulled elsewhere.
It was very clear that the best athletic years for a woman also coincide with the best years to become a mother. At that moment, being a mother was far more important. The feeling that arose in me is something that came from within. And that's how I experienced it. I had no doubt that being a mother would prevent me from competing because I had seen it with my teammates. And it was something I was very clear about. It was not possible. I couldn't do both things. No, being a mother was not compatible with the life we were leading at that time. Now, I really like that things have changed. I really like seeing how many cyclists are mothers and continue competing. I greatly value the effort behind it, how strong they are. Honestly, they have all my respect.
Her children have now grown up to become budding professional cyclists themselves, and Joanna has returned to the world of cycling as an advocate for the sport. The women's scene may have changed hugely since the day she raced, but one thing will go unchanged.
Joanna's legacy as one of the best cyclists that has ever been.
That was Joanna Somarribo. So interesting to talk to her. And she, I didn't actually put it in this feature, but I mean, she was so full of delight and admiration for Paola Blasi and all of her talent and, you know, what she could bring to the peloton in the coming years. It's a great time to talk to Somarriba because she obviously won two Maglia Rosas. And we have got the Giro d'Italia women starting this Saturday, isn't it, actually? It's coming right up really, really fast. At the Cycling Podcast Feminine, we are delighted to say that we are also doing daily coverage for the first time ever for the Giro d'Italia, Women's Giro d'Italia. So we are going to be delighted to be with you every evening after the stage, bringing you our sort of insight. We've kind of got the full crew on board, haven't we, in a sort of rotating system. Me, Rebecca, Denny and Lizzie Banks, of course, all rotating around on those dates. Well, we should, you know, tell listeners what they've got to look forward to. Denny, I mean, looking at the route, it's kind of a bit like the Tour de France Femmes has been for the last few years, where it's kind of really crescendoing, isn't it? We're sort of starting with a flat stage and then it just gets slightly kind of more unpredictable and more mountainous as we go on.
Yeah, obviously the third edition since RCS took over as organisers and the longest one that they've organised. And yeah, the first two stages look like nailed on sprints. The third could also be a sprint stage. And then we get a TT, an uphill TT on stage four to Nevergal. So that should definitely be quite decisive in the GC race. And then we move to the Dolomites for stage five, the first proper mountain day. We've got a couple of transition days on stages six and seven. And then stage eight is definitely the queen stage. Finishes on the Colle della Finestra. Obviously one of the most famous modern climbs in Italian cycling. Very long, very steep. And it has that kind of unpaved gravel section near the summit, which we've seen used in the men's race, but it's been added to the women's race for the first time. So that will be a real highlight and something to look forward to in the racing. And then the final stage is a finishing circuit around Saluzzo in Piedmont. It's kind of like a more compact stage, but could be decisive if the GC is still to be decided on the final stage. So it looks like quite a varied parcours, and yeah, hopefully we'll provide some really exciting racing, but definitely backloaded, as you say, Rose.
Yeah, it's very interesting, though. I mean, we say backloaded, but also that stage four uphill time trial is a really interesting prospect. I mean, we haven't seen loads of time trials be decisive in the past few years. I'm kind of looking, sort of rolling my eyes back into my brain as I try and remember if that's a true statement or not. But it hasn't felt like a lot has been riding on time trials for the past few years because the mountains have been so good, so big. Mountains have been so big, good. The mountains have been so big and so decisive. And we have, in previous history, kind of seen huge gaps on any mountain, you know, by 1 minute, 2 minutes. But that's not the nature of the peloton at the moment. Everything is very, very closely fought. So it'll be so interesting to see how this GC might develop through the week. And Becca, we're also seeing lots of big names here at the Giro, because obviously the Giro is far enough an hour away from the Tour de France that riders can be looking to do a Giro Tour double even. So we're seeing lots of big names, aren't we?
Yeah, which is really exciting. And as you've both said, like, I think the variety in stages is going to give us so many narratives and different talking points of different riders going for it. But yeah, top competitors, Vollering is going to be back after disappearing for a bit of specific training, let's say. Wiebes is back for those sprint stages. Nuova Doma, Marlin Reusser, Elisa Longo-Borghini, of course, back to defend. Elise Shabby, Anna Vadebrogen, Kat Ferguson, Balsamo and Nee Fisher-Black are listed as top competitors over on Pro Cycling Stats. Just reading those out. Other people that excite me, Sarah Gigante is going to be back as well. So I keep saying be back because we've had some riders away focusing on, as you say, this really big target with the Giro being in a different point in the calendar, but also riders coming back from injury. Marlin Reusser, we know, has yet again been taken out of quite a big injury, and she's going to be back fielding this, as far as we know. And Gigante as well broke her femur after just coming back to the top of her form yet again. As we know, she's had many, many comebacks now, so it'll be really interesting to see how Gigante's faring as well. So loads of massive names. And
did you mention Loretta Vibus?
She did mention Loretta Vibus.
She was right at the top, Demi.
I think she was every other rider, wasn't she, that she read out? It was like Demi Boering, yeah. Loretta Vibus, and Salongo Borghini, Loretta Vibus.
If anyone's playing a drinking game here, Weaver's bingo.
With your sparkling waters. Yeah, it's an intense drinking game. But I mean, there's such interesting names, aren't they? Because we really don't know where everyone sort of stands. Because as you say, Becca, there's been a lot of injury, illness, kind of absences with training blocks. I mean, the only person that we know has just been on fire this year and has had kind of an injury-free time also is Demi Vollering. I mean, she is kind of really the one to beat because she has been formidable through the classic season. So just seems to have so much power at the moment, and things have all been sort of going her way. I mean, she's obviously very happy in the team. We've talked about that a lot, and also just seeming to avoid illness, injury, crashes. You know, that's kept her on a steady progression. So we know that for sure. But I mean, the other riders, we really don't know. I mean, Kasia Niewiadoma will be there. She has had sort of been quite hit and miss. She's spoken quite openly about not being in the position that she wanted to be, not really being able to contend in the way that she wanted to contend. And we sort of saw that at the Volta Femminile, didn't we? That she wasn't quite there. So it's kind of a lot of intrigue, Denny, isn't there, with these particular riders? And I mean, that's going to make for some, I hope it doesn't make for cagey racing, because sometimes that is the way it goes. I hope it's kind of going to make for sort of fireworks, because people are going to want to be testing out their rivals, because we really don't know how well everyone is doing and where their strengths lie.
Yeah, let's hope so. I mean, I think when you've got a rider like Demi Vollering, who's been so dominant when she's wanted to target an event this year, it's really hard to look past her, isn't it? And I think that will set the tone for the GC battle. And I guess we'll learn very early on stage four the shape of the GC contenders and whether there'll be any riders that look like they'll be able to rival Demi Vollering. But the good thing, as you mentioned, is the fact that it is a bit further out from the tour. So that does give a bit more room for GC contenders to actually try and target this race, perhaps more than they would have if they were also riding the tour in previous years. So riders like Longo Borghini, who of course has such a good record in this race, Niewiadoma, Van der Breggen and others, could offer that rivalry that we want to see to engender a good race. I mean, I think the one thing that probably isn't in doubt is that Loretta Vibus would probably win a couple of stages if she continues her form, because she is unrivaled, isn't she, in sprint stages. But there are other sprinters there like Charlotte Kuhl and others as well that could offer a challenge if Vibus misfires on any stage.
Yeah, which could happen. We saw it at the Tour, didn't we, where we were sure that it would all be Loretta Vibus's way, and it didn't. It went in the hands of Charlotte Kuhl. But that leads me perfectly to say that we'll be back, listeners, for our Giro daily coverage. Me and Rebecca, we're taking the first one, thankfully, because it's a sprint stage. So I'm expecting...
I've just taken everybody else out.
Yeah, Rebecca's huge, long, just big philofax full of Loretta Vibus facts.
My leather-bound book is laminated.
Do need to get you a new one, don't we, Rebecca? So we got you a Ninka Vinka fan club book, but maybe we need to get you Loretta Vibus one as well. But yeah, we'll be kicking that off on Saturday. And yeah, tune in every night to hear about what happened at the Giro. It should be a really exciting race. I mean, that lineup is absolutely incredible. I mean, I'm kind of really glad that we are not missing out on having the daily coverage this year, because it's just absolutely fearsome competitors, huge kind of historic climbs, and it should be all to play for actually all week. So it's really, really thrilling that we get to do the daily coverage this year. But yes, well, I'll let you guys go and source your virtual or real? Wait a minute. I almost forgot to ask Denny about your cheeses. That's the most important thing about the Giro, is the fantastic Italian cheese.
Well, yes, of course, you know, most listeners, I think, have enjoyed our cheese coverage over the Tour de France fam. Few disagree, but yeah, Italian cheese is a different, a whole different area that we haven't covered yet, is it? And I've looked into a couple of, I have to say, I haven't tried as many Italian cheeses as I'd like, but I've looked into a couple. There's a cheese called Castelmagno, which is kind of produced in northern Italy, and the final stages finishes in Saluzzo. And I found a record, there's apparently a written record of this cheese, Castelmagno, which is like a blue cheese, sometimes kind of veiny, sometimes no blue veins at all, but it's a little bit like Stilton, I guess. But there's a reference to it in the records from 1277, when it was being handed over to the Marquis of Saluzzo in exchange for grazing rights in the mountains. So it's, you know, he was the Saluzzo, where the race kind of finishes, was a scene of cheese being used as payment for grazing rights. So yeah, that's one to look out for.
That is the podcast. I was going to say that is how you get paid, Denny, isn't it?
In my dreams, that would happen. We can arrange that. Maybe we should chat with Lionel about that.
Maybe we should. Well, thank you very much, both of you. Thank you, Rebecca.
Gracias, adios.
Oh, she's so good. And thank you very much, Denny.
Grazie.
And thank you, listeners. And please do join us for the Giro next week.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.